Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Gareth Barlow, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 30th of August, these are our main stories. The Russian mercenary boss Yevgeny Prigozhin has been buried during a private ceremony in St. Petersburg. The U.S. state of Florida braces for the arrival of Hurricane Idalia, which is being described as a potential once-in-a-lifetime event. And the authorities in Nigeria arrest dozens of men under anti-LGBT laws. Also in this podcast, why a watermark might help us determine between AI and authentic art. And could a bit of Mozart help reduce pain in babies? We go first to St. Petersburg, where a week after he and nine others died in a plane crash, the Wagner mercenary chief Yevgeny Prigozhin has been buried in a private funeral. The man who was once a key ally of Vladimir Putin had also become a vocal critic and dared to challenge the Kremlin. His demise, after launching a brief mutiny, was swift. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, has been to the site where he was buried.
I'm standing outside a cemetery on the edge of St. Petersburg. There is heavy security here, police all along the perimeter and inside the cemetery itself, which means we can't go in. Earlier today, Yevgeny Prigozhin was buried here. I can just about see his grave from where I'm standing. There's a Russian tricolour flying from it and the flag of Wagner. There had been no warning, no official announcement about what time and where Mr. Prigozhin's funeral would take place. Clearly the intention, either on the part of his family or what is left of the Wagner mercenary group, or on the part of the authorities, was to keep things very low-key. All day, St. Petersburg had been buzzing with rumours and speculation about where the mercenary chief would be laid to rest, with at least four different cemeteries named. 2 months ago, Yevgeny Prigozhin and his Wagner fighters launched an insurrection. It was over in a day, but it had been a direct challenge to President Putin's authority. Last week, Mr. Prigozhin was killed in a plane crash along with nine others on board. The Kremlin denies any involvement, but there is widespread suspicion that the crash was an act of revenge by the Russian authorities.
That was Steve Rosenberg reporting from St. Petersburg. The Russia editor for BBC Monitoring is Vitaly Shevchenko, and he told me more about the service.
St. Petersburg is Yevgeny Prigozhin's home city, and the cemetery in question, called Borkhovskaya, it's where his father is also buried, we understand. According to reports coming from Russia, he was buried in a private ceremony, which was the wish of his family. I think we can now say with almost complete certainty that we know where Yevgeny Prigozhin's body is right now.
There have been in recent days numerous makeshift shrines for Yevgeny Prigozhin, people who were in support of the Wagner mercenary group and what they had done for Russia. What do you think will happen to his grave and his body? Do you think this may well become a focal point? And if so, how do the authorities, how does the Kremlin respond to that?
It's obvious that the Kremlin doesn't really want Yevgeny Prigozhin to become a martyr for people who are supportive of the war but are just as critical of Russia's top brass as Yevgeny Prigozhin was. And one example of how the Kremlin is trying to contain the sentiment is all Russian state TV is saying about the plane crash that killed Yevgeny Prigozhin is that his plane crashed and he died, without venturing into speculation about what might have caused that plane crash.
And it is worth remembering, isn't it, that people who are critical of Vladimir Putin and his authority do die.
It's unfortunately true that this scenario fits the logic of Russia as it is now under President Vladimir Putin. If there was a message in this accident, it is, of course, aimed at people with easy access to money and weapons, people who might start to entertain any ideas of challenging the Kremlin. They will have to think twice.
That was Vitaly Shevchenko. A life-threatening hurricane is heading to Florida, with US media warning it could be a once-in-a-lifetime event for residents as it makes landfall on Wednesday. Schools have been closed and Tampa Airport has been shut. Evacuation orders have been issued. The authorities fear Hurricane Idalia could cause death and destruction. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, has urged people in low-lying coastal areas to move to higher ground before it's too late.
There have been evacuation orders issued for people on coastal areas, barrier islands, low-lying areas. You still have time, particularly if in the northern part of the state, to evacuate. You don't need to drive hundreds of miles. You don't need to try to outrun the storm. Just get to higher ground, get into a safe structure. Be advised, you've got time, but time is running out.
That was Ron DeSantis. Meanwhile, at a White House news briefing, Deanne Criswell, who is the administrator of the U.S. Disaster Relief Agency, FEMA, gave this update on the hurricane.
This storm is very strong and is expected to strengthen to a major hurricane by the time it makes landfall due to high surface temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico. This means heavy winds, high winds, heavy rain, and a forecasted 12-foot storm surge in some of the areas along the western coast. This is one of the highest risk parts of a hurricane and is especially problematic along the west coast of Florida.
While also speaking to reporters at the White House was President Biden. He said federal help was being provided to the state.
We're in constant contact. I had the director of FEMA in here today, earlier talking about it. Hour to hour we're watching this, and I told the governor that and the mayor that we're there as long as it takes. We're going to make sure they have everything they need.
The BBC's Luis Fajardo is in Miami.
In Florida, there is a substantial amount of alarm. There are nearly 27 counties of Florida which have some kind of evacuation order. Authorities have, for example, removed tolls from many major highways in the state. And a lot of people are taking preparations with this storm, which has a very risky characteristic, the possibility of having a storm surge early on Wednesday morning local time when it's expected to make landfall in Florida. Basically, the sea floods into land areas, coastal areas. This happens fairly quickly, and it can cause an enormous amount of damage, both in physical terms and in loss of life.
Are people heeding the warnings in Florida?
That is always a concern. Every year, there's thousands of people who decide not to evacuate, even if they're told in very strong terms by the authorities. In some cases, it is recent arrivals who perhaps don't realize the danger they sometimes face. That was certainly the case last year during Hurricane Ian, when many people didn't actually evacuate. And unfortunately, the death toll was substantial. And this particular part of Florida, where the hurricane is supposed to have a direct impact, the so-called Big Bend. It is a relatively less densely populated area of the state, but it is an area of the state that unusually has not had a direct impact by this kind of hurricane in more than 100 years. And this also could potentially make it more dangerous.
Give us a sense of what's happening on a state and also federal level.
Certainly, the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, has called for a federal declaration of emergency, which expedites the delivery of emergency assets to the region. There's thousands of Florida state troopers, National Guard, also being mobilized. They are moving fuel resources around. The local power utilities are also moving hundreds, in some cases thousands, of people to prepare them to go into action immediately after the hurricane and to make sure that the power goes back on, which is particularly crucial in this time of the year when Florida is facing extremely high temperatures.
And you can keep up to date with developments on our website at bbc.com/news. Police in Nigeria say they've detained at least 67 men who were arrested while they were celebrating a wedding in one of the country's largest arrests targeting homosexuality. About 200 people were initially detained at the event in a hotel in Delta State. Our reporter is Nduka Oronomo.
The police announced that they had arrested the man they said was dressed as a woman in the late hours of Sunday. And he said he was an actor who was in Delta State in South Nigeria to shoot a movie. But they arrested this person, took him to the police station. And the police said he then told them that he belonged to a gay society that was holding an event. And he led the police to this event, where the police then arrested 200 men. They said they found most of the men dressed as women. They found two men who were dressed as bride and groom. and they saw a recording of what apparently was a wedding that had taken place between both men. At the moment, they are getting ready to charge 67 of those men when they are done with their investigations. That's what they said. So some of those men were then released. We don't know how the police came to that decision to hold just 67 of them.
Now, for their part, the people who have been detained say they were models, they were photographers, they were actors, that this wasn't a gay wedding. And perhaps that response is not surprising, considering that homosexuality is outlawed in Nigeria. And there are, especially in some of the northern states of the country, potentially death penalties as a result. But throughout Nigeria, very harsh penalties for people to be found to be engaging in homosexual activity.
Yeah, exactly. It carries a 14-year jail term here to be involved in homosexual activities. Even those who tagged as accomplices. So in this case, the hotel owner, for instance, or the manager of the hotel where that event was held, according to the police, can be charged for being an accomplice. But it's not the first time that such arrests would be made. A couple of years back, the police also arrested men they said were at a gay event in Lagos and charged them to court, and nothing came out of it. The men denied that they had been there for other purposes rather than what the police accused them of.
Nduka Oronimo there. The security forces in the Central African state of Gabon have arrested an opposition leader who was part of a coalition that challenged President Ali Bongo in elections on Saturday. Rachel Wright reports.
The vice president of the Party for the Reappropriation of Gabon was taken to the military intelligence headquarters in the capital, Libreville. According to his colleague, no reason was given for the arrest. There are also reports that troops have been deployed near the homes of other opposition leaders. Gabon held presidential elections on the 26th of August that were widely marked by irregularities. President Ali Bongo was accused of electoral fraud by the opposition. The government in turn shut down the internet and imposed a curfew and a ban on French media outlets. It remains unclear when the results of the ballot will be released.
The BBC's Rachel Wright. As artificial intelligence evolves, some images can make us question if they're real or whether they've been digitally created or enhanced. You may have seen a photo of Pope Francis wearing a white puffer coat that was widely shared a few months ago, only to be revealed as an AI-generated image. Now, the Google company DeepMind is trialling a digital watermark, which it says will be able to detect images created by artificial intelligence. So how does it all work? Our technology reporter, Chris Vallance, explains.
It's a bit different from those ones you used to get in banknotes. You know, you can hold them up to the light and suddenly an image appears, or a watermark appears. DeepMind's Synth ID system makes changes to an image that are imperceptible to the human eye, but which an AI system can spot. So then that AI can say, look, this is an AI-generated image. Now, obviously, that's an advantage for two reasons. Firstly, if the watermark was visible, you might be able to try and remove it much more easily, or crop the image so that you didn't include the watermark. And secondly, if you could see the watermark, of course, that would reduce the value of the image if you're using the AI generation for purposes other than misinformation, or maybe to generate, a corporate logo or a piece of art to illustrate an article or something like that, where you don't want the watermark visible.
I'm cognizant of just how much content is generated every second of the day on the internet. With that in mind, just how effective could this tool be for countering disinformation?
DeepMind calls this an experimental launch, and only some users of its Imagine system are going to get to try it out. But there has been a commitment from the big AI firms to develop these watermarking tools. That was part something that came out of a meeting at the White House where they talked about the threats of that AI tools could present. And of course, this comes with the prospect of elections in the US looming ever closer. And it also, these kinds of technologies have uses beyond misinformation. Just as a consumer of content, it'd be quite important to know that perhaps the piece of art you're looking at, for example, was generated by a computer, not an artist in their garret. So there are other uses for this technology as well.
Chris Vallance there. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
We see a high level of violence at sea, especially from sub-Saharan African and Tunisian migrants. Some have threatened to throw babies in the sea. Others have threatened to set themselves on fire.
A special report on the desperate lengths some people will go to escape from Africa to Europe. Police in Canada say they've brought an additional 12 charges against a man accused of supplying a poisonous chemical to people in more than 40 countries. Kenneth Law, who's 57 and from Ontario, was charged in May this year with two counts of counselling or aiding suicide. On Friday, the UK's National Crime Agency revealed he sold the substance to 88 people in the UK who later died. Angus Crawford reports.
11 separate police forces in the province of Ontario are now investigating deaths linked to Kenneth Law in what today was described as a very active and a very complex investigation. At a press conference, it was revealed that Mr. Law has now been charged with an additional 12 counts of counselling or aiding suicide, bringing the total number of charges to 14. The dead are thought to range in age from 16 to 36. On Friday of last week, the National Crime Agency here revealed that Mr. Law had sent the substance to more than 270 people in the UK, 88 of whom later died, although it's not possible to link the chemical to the cause of death in all cases. Inspector Simon James from Ontario's York Regional Police said they were talking to investigators around the world.
And we are cooperating and sharing information with law enforcement on a global scale. Let us be clear that we will not tolerate criminal actions by those who prey on vulnerable individuals in our communities, and we will hold those responsible accountable.
He confirmed that Kenneth Law sent more than 1,200 packages to more than 40 countries and revealed that as well as selling the toxic chemical, the 57-year-old sent other equipment to assist clients to end their lives and warned families to be vigilant about what loved ones had been buying online.
That was Angus Crawford. The Himalayan region of Kashmir has been a flashpoint between India and Pakistan for decades. It's one of the world's most militarised zones. In August 2019, with little warning, India stripped the Indian-administered part of Kashmir of its special autonomous status and brought it under central government control. That followed years of communal violence between Muslims and Hindus. It also split it into territories, Jammu and Kashmir and Ladakh. 4 years later, the Supreme Court has now asked the government to provide a time frame to return it to its previous status. The newsroom's Lipa Kapelam told me more.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi and ruling Hindu nationalist BJP party had long opposed Article 370, which gave Kashmir, India's only Muslim-majority state, limited autonomy. Scrapping it was part of the BJP's 2019 election manifesto. It was aimed at tightening Delhi's grip over the disputed region in the name of national security.
Given that this was such a central pillar for the BJP's election manifesto back in 2019, how has the government responded today?
The position of the central government that Jammu and Kashmir will get back its statehood is not a new one. In October 2021, during his visit to Kashmir, the Home Minister, Amit Shah, promised that the statehood would be restored soon without specifying a time frame. And Mr. Mehta, the Solicitor General, told the court the current status was not a permanent feature, in his words, and that Kashmir would be reversed to a state once normality has returned. And the spokesperson for the BJP for Kashmir has recently claimed that since the abrogation of 370, tourism is at an all-time high. And for the first time, an international event such as G20 Summit on Tourism took place there earlier this year.
Which brings us on to how has the last 4 years changed the lives of the people living in the region?
Human rights activists in both India and abroad have accused Delhi of intimidation and indiscriminate arrests, including of journalists in the territory. And residents and local politicians call the move as the BJP's bid to impose what they call settler colonialism, which is aimed at changing the demography of the region and land ownership. And now, despite the Supreme Court's demand, people in the valley say they have little hope anything will change.
That was Lipika Pelham. With only 200 kilometres of water separating it from the Italian island of Lampedusa, the Tunisian coastline has now become the busiest route in the world for migrants looking for a way into Europe. In the first 6 months of this year, nearly 55,000 people were picked up by the Italian or Tunisian coast guards. That's according to the United Nations. That's almost double the number who attempted the crossing in all of 2022. BBC Arabic's Bassem Benoui went on patrol with the Tunisian Coast Guard, witnessing 9 migrant boats intercepted in just 24 hours.
Within half an hour of us boarding the Coast Guard's patrol boat, the radar intercepts its first signal. At first, 2 smaller, more agile speedboats are deployed to locate the migrant boat before towing it back. But as the boat's 46 passengers begin to disembark, the Tunisian Coast Guards are met with a wave of anger. Let us through to Italy, one of them shouts. All from West Africa, mostly Guinea and the Ivory Coast. Many of them tell us it's their third, even fourth attempt to cross this small stretch of sea.
We are also humans. We also want to be happy. Our families back home have nothing. We are trying to get to Europe to send money home.
Tunisia is a poor country. We do not have jobs. We do not know where we will sleep. Let us leave.
Although we are allowed to follow the operation, the 6 coast guards on board are not answering any of our questions. Instead, their spokesman, Hussein Eddin Jbabli, speaks to us back at the port.
We see a high level of violence at sea, especially from sub-Saharan African and Tunisian migrants. Some have threatened to throw babies in the sea. Others have threatened to set themselves on fire.
After releasing all the passengers back onto Tunisian soil, the ship's radar soon detects another boat. It's a makeshift iron boat, around 20 people on board, begging us for food and water. They say they've been adrift for more than 12 hours. Hailing from Sudan, Yemen, Libya and Syria, they tell us they're fleeing from war. Sailing back out into the channel, we see many clothes and shoes floating on the water. Local authorities say more than 700 unidentified people, including infants, have been buried in unmarked graves on the outskirts of Sfax since the beginning of this year. Another vessel, but this time full of Tunisians, hailing from one of the poorest suburbs of Tunis, Sabr Haji says this was his fourth failed attempt.
I no longer care. I have already lost everything. So I will take a gamble on my life because I feel as if I am already dead.
As we drive away from the port, there are dozens of migrants walking along the side of the road. We will sleep here tonight in these olive groves, one man tells us. And then we will try again, says another. Despite the chance of being intercepted again and the very risk of drowning, these young men are resolute. They will try to reach Europe again.
BBC Arabic's Bassem Benoui with that report. A former world champion and a young American player he accused of cheating have resolved their year-long dispute that's gripped the world of chess. The Norwegian Magnus Carlsen had made the claims after he was unexpectedly beaten by Hans Niemann in a tournament last September. The American had denied any wrongdoing, although he did admit to cheating in 2 online games when he was 12 and 16. With more details, here's Sean Coughlin.
This was a scandal that rocked the chess world. Magnus Carlsen, the 5 times world champion, had made accusations of cheating after losing to his young rival, the 20-year-old prodigy Hans Niemann. The acrimonious dispute had prompted elaborate theories on social media about high-tech methods for cheating, such as hidden electronic devices or vibrating anal beads. Mr. Neiman responded by saying he would play naked to show nothing was being concealed, and, in his next move, launched a $100 million lawsuit to clear his name. But the online platform, chess.com, says an out-of-court agreement has now been reached, with an acceptance that there was no cheating, everything was above board, and the two men can play again.
Sean Coughlin there. Now, there may be a rather simple way to provide pain relief to babies. It's to play them something like this. It's a lullaby by Mozart. That's the suggestion from research just published by Thomas Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia. Rebecca Slater, who is Professor of Paediatric Neuroscience at Oxford University, told Sarah Montague about it.
They've conducted a really well-designed study where they've taken 100 babies and half of them have listened to Mozart during a painful procedure and the other half haven't. And what they've found is for the ones that listened to Mozart during this procedure, which was a blood test where the heel of the foot is pricked, was that these babies showed less pain according to a clinical pain score.
Right. So what do we think is going on?
So the idea is that by providing comforting stimulation, in this case, listening to a piece of music by Mozart, it might be able to change the way a baby responds to a painful procedure. So what they're doing is they're looking at the way babies respond by looking at their facial activity or how much they cry or whether their breathing rates go up or down. And they're using all of this information to get a pain score. And what they're finding is that when the babies are listening to the music, they're having less of this type of response following the heel lance.
Now, it used to be thought that babies didn't feel pain in the same way as adults, but it was your research that disproved that.
So it wasn't just my research. There are lots of groups that have really shown now that babies do show responses to painful procedures. Certainly, we did some work recently looking at changes in brain activity. But prior to that, it's been known for a long time now that babies do respond to pain.
Just like adults?
Similar to adults. So if you look at the change in brain activity that you see in an adult when they tell you they're in pain, it's really similar to that you'll see in a baby when they can't tell you. So we can make some assumptions about the experience that the babies are having, even though they can't talk.
I mean, do we know if it's music or do we know if it has to be Mozart?
Well, there's definitely no evidence from this study that it has to be Mozart. And it could be that all different types of music might be helpful. But they chose Mozart because it's got lots of minor tones and it's also got a soothing effect, which is why it's been part of this album that they've used in order to help provide this stimulation.
Do we know if a mother's voice or a father's voice has any effect?
So that's another area of research that other groups have done. And yes, it's also been shown that when parents talk to their babies, this can be helpful. So perhaps parents singing lullabies might be another way in which we can provide additional comfort for these babies during the procedures.
I wonder if there's a longer term effect as well. Do we know that pain in babies has longer term consequences?
So we do. There's been lots of studies suggesting that pain in early life can alter the way that you respond to pain when you're older. So one of the questions would be that if you provide these interventions in early life, can you actually change the way that they respond later? But certainly this hasn't been done in this study, but it's something that could be looked into.
What about music for adults when they're having some painful procedure?
I mean, certainly some women really like to have music going through intense experiences such as childbirth. So I imagine there'd be lots of benefits for adults as well.
That was Rebecca Slater speaking to Sarah Montague. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the podcast a little later. If you want to comment on this one or any of the topics, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, of course, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Guzaris, the producer Emma Joseph, the editor Cara Martin. I'm Gareth Barlow, and until next time, goodbye.